From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noah.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, all Mission Control Deckant. Most importantly, you are here, and that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. Our story today takes place a little bit more than 76 years ago. It's about 30 miles north of San Francisco, in the Bay. It's a story that includes a number of proposed conspiracies and a number of proven conspiracies. And while you may not have heard of this story before, it is a story that fundamentally changed the course of the United States. It's known as the Port Chicago disaster. Did you guys ever hear about this before in grade school or growing up?
I don't recall learning about it in school. However, I traveled to Vallejo, California, which is right in the very close in that area, and I learned about it after hearing about the naval history of Mare Island, which is very close to there too. But that's the only time I've ever encountered it.
Yeah, and Mare Island's going to come up in this story quite a bit as well. I had never heard a peep about it, and was actually quite surprised to learn that the Port Chicago has absolutely nothing to do with Illinois or the Midwest at all,
or the band Chicago even.
No, but it does turn out that 25 or 6 to 4 is when whoever the main Chicago dude is was trying to figure out a closing line to the song, and he looked at his watch, and it was 25 or 6 minutes to 4, which seems like quite a large gap there, but that's the lore of that song.
And here are the facts. So despite the name, nothing to do with Illinois, nothing to do with Chicago, the band, or the metropolis. Port Chicago was a town located in California, 30 miles north of San Francisco, and was once upon a time called Bay Point because it was created in part by something called the Bay Point Land Company. However, Port Chicago was not like a normal town, at least in conception.
No, it was a town with a purpose, with a mission. It was developed specifically to serve and support a giant munitions facility. And that is because that island that Matt mentioned, Mare Island, also had a naval ammunition depot there that was starting to not quite cut it for the war effort on its own. So they needed an additional depot and factory to support the war effort out of California.
And, you know, there's the Port Chicago that has the pier where all of that ammunitions loading and all that occurs. But there's also a town where the people would live that worked there if you didn't live, you know, on the facility, like in the base, essentially. There's a population in that small town of around 1,500, and it was located only about a mile and a half away from where those ships were located.
Yeah, and this will be important to the story later. So this is a purpose-built town. In some ways, it's similar to places like Oak Ridge, Tennessee, or some of the closed cities in the former USSR. But make no mistake, even though Port Chicago, the town, was relatively small in terms of population, it was a huge deal to Uncle Sam. Business was booming. By the summer of 1944, the newly minted facility had already expanded such that they could load two ships concurrently around the clock, so 24/7, two ships in and then two ships out. Business was also terrible in addition to booming. Whether you thought it was awesome or terrible depended on your role in the process, because the Navy and all of the armed services at this time were still segregated. And that meant the dangerous, awful, crappy jobs like loading live munitions were typically assigned to the African-American units. And these guys were not, what's the old saying? These guys were not set up for success by their superiors or command structure.
No, it makes me think of the term cannon fodder that you hear oftentimes. And there are, you know, hellish stories of African-American troops being put on the front line as essentially human pawns, you know, to be kind of to soak up the brunt of an onslaught so that the folks in the back could maybe live on to fight another day. And this is not dissimilar from that. It's not direct combat, but it's involving the handling of some very unstable and dangerous munitions without proper training.
Yeah, I mean, think about that. These are high explosive materials and projectiles, essentially, that they're handling without proper training. These guys that were forced to do this work were trained for hand-to-hand combat, for, you know, other combat roles with weapons and such, but they didn't have any official training on how to do what they were doing at night, in the middle of the night, after working all day. And they were, you know, they were told to do this without training by their white superior officers.
And in addition to that, they had these incredibly hectic loading schedules. The people on the front lines will die if we don't get this stuff out in time. And it always needs to be there yesterday. So safety standards, like it's similar in some ways to the COVID problems in productions today, safety standards were either diminished or ignored outright. What could go wrong? Like, this is a bit of a tangent, but, you know, in a lot of productions nowadays, film productions, or I think TV productions as well, there is someone who is hired as a COVID compliance officer or something like that. And nobody really listens to them. They've got a terrible job because they're supposed to speak truth to power. And you guys know the hierarchy of sets. You can't, even if you're right, you can't go up to the director or some A-list celebrity and be like, hey, you know, legally it's mask time, Morgan Freeman or whatever. You'll get fired. And that's what's happening.
Well, that's true. But yes, I agree with you completely, Ben. But also, like, that it is, if one person on a set gets COVID, the whole production has to shut down. And I've heard of that happening quite a few times, you know, here in our little film bubble of Atlanta. But I wanted to double back on one tiny thing I said, talking about the things they were handling being unstable. There is some truth to that, but it's interesting because munitions up until the late 1800s had been, or explosives rather, had been incredibly unstable. And then Nobel invented dynamite, Alfred Nobel, in the 1860s, which was like a way of stably handling explosives that were, you know, stronger than black powder, which had been like the kind of explosive du jour before that. And I learned a little bit about this listening to the great podcast Omnibus with Ken Jennings and John Roderick. And I think it's really ironic and probably not lost on anybody that Alfred Nobel in inventing dynamite, he prevented people from blowing themselves up accidentally by handling munitions and things like that, but also made it much more possible to spread the use of these type of explosives and, you know, kill people with them on purpose. So he, in order to maybe maintain his legacy, started the whole Nobel Peace Prize.
Right. But the philosophical question there is, it's an important one. Does that make your hands clean?
Right. You know,
did building the Winchester Mansion in some way spiritually exonerate the Winchester widow from all the deaths on the other end of the Winchester repeating rifle? Story for another day, but let's talk about the ammunition. That's a good direction to go. So on July 17th, 1944, the guys on the evening shift, to Matt, to your very important point, they were speed loading these two merchant ships, the SS Quinault Victory and the SS E.A. Bryan. The holds were being packed with like 4,600 tons of various explosives, bombs, depth charges, plain old ammunition. And then there were another 400 tons of explosives waiting nearby on rail cars. Southern Pacific, by the way, goes straight through town so they can carry this stuff from the factories.
And just to everyone understands, I didn't fully understand this. The cargo hold of a large ship like that is kind of in the center, and it's like a cavernous hole that, imagine one just filled with these explosives. With that amount, I mean, it has to be at least 2,000 tons each for those ships that they're loading up, you know, And just imagine, like, 2,000 times 2,000. Good God, that is so much explosive.
Yeah, and picture like a Hostess cupcake, I'm going to say, because I barely ate today. Picture like a Hostess cupcake, the kind with the little lace on the top and the little cream in the middle. Or a cream-filled donut, whatever, your choice. That's kind of this cargo hold situation. So
With two big ships.
This was a ginormous operation. There were hundreds of people in the area. There were about 320, as far as we can tell, on or near the pier when something went wrong at exactly 10:18. A series of massive explosions resounded through the night, creating blasts that were felt as far away as Nevada.
That's right. And we'll talk more about this, but those explosions destroyed everything and killed every person who was working there that night.
Yeah, vaporized them, evaporated them.
Like
we know there were 320 people there from records, more so than unfortunately, than finding a lot of corpses.
Not even like dental records where they could like match the remains. Like, I mean, when you say vaporized, I mean, you basically mean like turned to dust.
Disintegrate, yeah.
Yeah, the largest remaining pieces of the E.A. Bryan, for instance, which is a 7,200-ton ship itself, the largest remaining pieces of it were about the size of a suitcase. So there was no stone standing on another situation. And the actual damage, stretched all the way south into San Francisco, somewhere between 30 and 48 miles. Every building, remember Port Chicago, the town's a mile and a half away, every building takes this tremendous amount of damage. There's not a pane of glass left in town. People were knocked off their feet. And here's a fun fact to ruin conversations with your friends. Despite what we see in action films, any explosion powerful enough to knock someone off their feet also usually does very serious damage to their bodies. Shout out to Rachel Lance, who has been a guest on some of our shows in the past. She is an expert, one of the world's foremost experts in underwater explosions, which I did not know is a job you could have.
It's the coolest job, or at least the most niche job, but also the coolest, most niche job, and really enjoyed talking to her about that.
Yeah, and so she can verify this. Oddly enough, through some remarkable coincidence, a bunch of the town's residents are harmed, but none are killed. They're much more lucky than the people at the pier.
Would that have been by like flying debris, perhaps, or some kind of shockwave? Yeah,
they were harmed by a shockwave. They were harmed by all the splintering glass and all of the debris shooting out from the sort of origin point of this series of explosions.
One thing that I found most memorable from our conversation with Rachel Lance is that these shockwaves can be incredibly damaging, underwater in particular too. We're talking about the SS Hunley, or wasn't the SS, it was just the Hunley. It was this Civil War era submarine, and the question was, how were the people that were killed in the testing of this vehicle, well, it wasn't testing, in the use of this very rudimentary vehicle, killed? And her kind of thesis is that it was the shockwave, underwater shockwave, that actually can cause like internal damage. Like it can like eviscerate your internal organs. So nothing to sneeze at, these shockwaves.
So let's imagine the explosion as it's occurring. When this initial explosion occurs, and then there's just so many more that follow, whatever caused the biggest one, and it's most likely that it was in the E.A. Bryan, with all of those tons of explosives, there was smoke and fire that just leapt into the air. It was almost 2 miles high when people were observing it. There was a pilot in the area who was flying about 9,000 feet up, noticed that there were metal chunks the size of, a house from the explosion flying past him. The other ship, the Quinault that we were talking about, it in the aftermath, when it was found, there was just a tiny piece of it that was sticking up vertically, essentially. That was one of the biggest pieces of wreckage that was discovered there. Just insane when you think about the force that was exerted from this explosion.
Right. And insane when you think that that pilot made it through to relay this story. Yeah, this the cause of this explosion, as you said, Matt, we don't it remains unknown today. And that is because all of the evidence that would have been helpful from a forensic standpoint was destroyed moments, like milliseconds, a few seconds after that that first explosion at 10:18. This makes the Port Chicago disaster the largest man-made detonation in history to that point, by a healthy margin, too. Like pre-nuclear weaponry deployment, this is the largest explosion. Nearly two-thirds of the people who lost their lives at Port Chicago that evening were African-American enlisted men serving in the Navy. Here's another troubling statistic. In that one night, the deaths in that one night equal 15% of all African-Americans killed throughout the entirety of World War II. And the people who did survive somehow, who were far enough away to just get away with some injuries or something, they were still treated horribly afterwards. The white officers supervising them were given hardship leaves. What a terrible disaster. Go take some time, be with your family. But the black survivors were ordered to clean up the base, lickety-split, including picking up the remains of their dead colleagues. Yeah. So you have to go and again, this is, when we say remains, we're not talking about a coherent single body. We're talking about pieces of people.
Yeah, and according to stories, many of them worked for 2 or 3 days straight, attempting to clean up the entire area.
The absolute worst possible job that someone could be asked to do. You know, I can't even imagine being able to like look at my superior with a straight face and be like, sir, yes, sir. But it gets worse, doesn't it?
Gets much worse, yeah. The surviving men are quickly reassigned to the nearby Mare Island, and they're expected to carry on, just to carry on. That's a state of war. Today, we call this, as we said, the Port Chicago disaster, but in a very real way, that explosion is just the beginning of the story. We'll pause for a word from our sponsor and dive in after this break. Here's where it gets crazy. Fast forward, it's less than a month later, the Navy starts ordering members of these segregated units to load more munitions. They still have not received the training they needed, by the way.
Yeah, but they wanted the training. They were calling for the training.
They've been asking for it, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's not as though it was something that was being neglected by the sailors themselves. And there were 258 sailors who then went on a work stoppage, or a strike, essentially. They caused a work stoppage.
Yeah, and you know, this isn't like a civilian strike. I mean, it's essentially, you know, refusing the orders of a commanding officer at this point, which is sort of frowned upon in the military.
Certainly is, but you know, these are men that don't have weapons that are essentially saying I'm striking my work. I don't know. It feels different than, I don't know, the way it's described, at least.
No. I'm just saying that's how it would be viewed, I think, from the brass's perspective. You know, it's like you are disobeying a direct order.
Yeah, that's correct. In Matt, as you said, calling a work stoppage or strike is the perfect description for the civilian world. That's what everybody would call it. In the Navy, this refusal to work did count in their mind as mutiny. And there was there were a number of detainments and arrests. One building was converted into a brig to hold these people, but it was never meant to hold 258 people. There's a point there about direct orders. One of the big questions is, were these 258 men directly asked to load munitions? And if not, were they just saying, well, I'm not going to volunteer for it, right? There's a guy named Lieutenant Gerald E. Veltman who heads the defense, and he says these accusations of mutiny are incorrect, and pretty certain that in his personal life, he thought that some of this stuff was racially motivated. He had a pretrial brief wherein he cites the definition of mutiny from a thing called Winthrop's Military Law and Precedents, and he says, look, the 50 people who are getting straight up charged with mutiny said, look, there's no proof that they conspired. They didn't get together and say, we're going to usurp, subvert, or override superior military authority. They just did not want to die.
Right. I always thought of a mutiny as sort of like the equivalent of like a coup on the high seas, where you are colluding to overthrow the commander of the vessel or the authority structure of the vessel and take over, and oftentimes with ill intent, right?
Yeah. Like most of us in the U.S., when we think of mutiny, the most famous one for us would be the Mutiny on the Bounty. Which led to the creation of the nation we know as the Pitcairn Islands today. And the Pitcairn Islands should be a story. It should be an episode of their own. Are you guys too familiar with that?
No.
It sounds so familiar, but I don't know.
There's a long running intergenerational child abuse situation there, and I think the current mayor was involved, still mayor, was reelected. It's going to be one of those episodes where we have to say at the top it may not be suitable for all audience members, but in the meantime, folks, do a little digging of your own if you'd like before we get to it. It's a shame, but that's the most famous mutiny.
Yeah, no, for sure. Well, let's just go back quickly to that concept of the mutiny and what actually occurred. There's a video you can watch right now on YouTube. It's called Remembering Port Chicago. It's put out there by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. And in it, there's described one of the first actions that was taken that was considered a mutiny or a mutinous by the commanding officers. And it was literally to not turn a certain way when the commanding officer gave them an order to turn, I guess, to then head in to the facility where they would begin working and, you know, loading the munitions and things. And it literally started there, and then it just kind of
snowballed, right?
Snowballed, exactly. And like to Ben's point, it wasn't as though everybody, or at least to the historical record, it is not known if there was a big meeting or something to decide that this was going to occur.
Right. Some people got together allegedly and said, let's have this work stoppage. You know, let's not repeat the mistakes that occurred in Port Chicago. But then there were other people who were caught up in the crossfire of systemic racism because they were told, there's one account that just says, look, we were told to stand in a line. And then our officers told us, okay, if you don't want to, if you're not going to load munitions, step to your, you know, right, or step to your left, if you are. And then the people who just said, I don't want to do that, got jailed, which I feel like maybe there was a different answer if you knew this was, so much was riding on this question. But like you guys established earlier, Veltman hits on some consistent points. He said many of these men, like you said, Matt, have not been asked directly to do anything. And the ones who refused often said, look, I'm only refusing because I need some training. I need safety protocols. They're not even giving these people gloves, by the way. And then while they were saying this, they were carrying out other unrelated tasks, you know, maintenance, cleaning, stuff like that. And they also made no threats. You know, they weren't like, we're going to string you up, so-and-so. So he makes a pretty good case that whatever the definition of mutiny is, the Port Chicago 50, as they came to be known, do not fit the definition. Their actions don't fit the definition. But he lost that argument, didn't he?
He did indeed. The prosecution, which was led by Lieutenant Commander James F. Coakley, replied that any persistent refusal to work by two or more men was in itself sufficient proof of a conspiracy. to override authority, and as such was tantamount to a mutiny, which I would argue, I mean, I'm not a naval lawyer or anything, but I would argue that's some pretty creative thinking there, some very circuitous arguing.
Yeah, it's like, at what point does it become a conspiracy, right? The etymology of conspiracy is just to breathe together. So you're whispering or silent together. I don't know. And how does the military handle this? Because chain of command is so fundamentally important, right?
Yeah. Just imagine the embarrassment that the United States Navy was feeling in those months, right? The mm-hmm. embarrassment that the largest explosion up until that point had occurred on their soil, involving their, you know, their own sailors and their munitions and all. It was just, I can't imagine the embarrassment. And it feels like an act to almost, I don't know, an act to shift blame, maybe?
Yes.
Or an act, right?
Yeah, absolutely. This is absolutely looking for someone to point a finger at, even if it's not directly related to the explosion, looking for a vulnerable group to scapegoat.
Almost a diversion, right? It's like, look yes. over here at these guys who broke the rules and disobeyed direct orders, as opposed to look at us, you know, sitting high and mighty in our commander's chairs, which is a thing, because it was ultimately on them to provide the proper training, which clearly wasn't done and clearly made these. It's one thing to go into battle, one thing to go into war where you know what the score is. You know, there are people literally coming at you to kill you. You would not expect that treatment among your commanding officers and your colleagues.
Agreed. And so, although clearly it seems like the three of us are on Veltman's side in this pretrial conversation, he lost the argument. The trial began on September 14th of that year. All 50 men pled not guilty to the charges, but what happened next, we'll tell you after a word from our sponsor. So we have a pretty extensive record of the ins and outs of the trial. There are a lot of not completely above board things that happened in this trial. It came out that some of the sailors who had been accused during their interviews, there was an armed guard stationed there. They had one guy said that Coakley threatened to shoot him if he didn't have an answer. Both sides accused the other of coaching the witnesses or the accused. There were statements from the superior officers who said things like, okay, I directly ordered maybe these six guys to load munitions, and they said no. But I can't say that I ordered 50 people to do that, let alone 258.
Jeez. Well, yeah, and I think is it the same officer or different officer who goes on to explain that all of the men over whom he had command would follow pretty much any order, any and all orders that were given to them besides the order to load more munitions?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was the same person.
Yeah, Commander Joseph R. Tobin. He said, and he also said, look, these... nobody was being aggressive or aggro at me. He didn't say aggro, but you know what I mean. And he said no one was being disrespectful. They just didn't want to do this unless they had the proper training. Because again, like we said earlier, these guys are trained for combat, and they just got pulled into munitions because it was a micro-esque dirty job. And increasingly, race played a huge public role in this, and some troubling facts emerged, both about how the commanding officers saw the enlisted men and then how they treated them, right? Because there's some explanations we found.
Yeah, and a pretty salacious, you know, kind of rumor milly kind of detail emerged through some hearsay that was kind of exposed during the trial. And it was the notion that someone was heard telling the men, quote, don't go work for those white motherfuckers. And, you know, it was just a claim, and it wasn't really verifiable, right, Ben?
Yeah, you're right, Noel. There's a lot of hearsay that takes place in this original trial. It's a lot of well, I heard the blah, blah, blah did that. And it's influenced a lot by the rank of the person testifying or speaking. But there was a troubling explanation that emerged in the course of this investigation, and it explains why there was little regard for safety. It turns out that the officers had a kind of conspiracy or a sport of their own, and they were using teams of loaders as the pawns in their game, right?
I mean, yeah, again, we were talking about that cannon fodder situation. They were essentially cracking the whip seemingly for their own amusement. I mean, again, this could be taken in many different ways, but possibly as a way of increasing productivity or maybe encouraging the men in kind of like a playful way to outdo each other. But there was this concept that emerged that the commanding officers were encouraging races or even like requiring races among the teams with zero regard for their safety. If they already had any, this was even more of an escalation of that absolute disregard for the safety of these men. And they were making bets. So it's essentially, it's the most dehumanizing treatment of these men who were already being treated pretty inhumanely.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you could say it was meant to be like a motivating thing, mm-hmm. right? We're getting these out quickly. So maybe it wasn't meant to be as dangerous as it was. There were also the Longshore Union warned them that something bad was going to happen when they were moving these munitions so quickly and so haphazardly. So 208 of those guys don't get charged with mutiny. They get bad conduct discharges, which affects their status as veterans, and they have to forfeit their pay. But the other men,
Their pay affects their status in all ways, just in life, just losing all the pay that they would have gotten.
Yes, that is absolutely correct. And the other 50 men that we call the Port Chicago 50 today were ultimately convicted of mutiny, and they were given incredibly cartoonishly harsh sentences, 15 years of prison, along with hard labor, along with a dishonorable discharge as a little cherry on the top. So now these guys aren't just scapegoats, or they're not just a diversion, right? They are examples to every other member of the armed services, an example that says, step out of line and we will put you down.
Yeah, and it really did. It painted these 50 men as bad guys. And in a way, the Navy is commenting on the 320 men who lost their lives in the actual Port Chicago disaster by doing this to these 50 men. And again, we're talking about shifting the blame. It's just pretty tragic that occurs. And when it does occur, it catches the attention of a lot of people. It becomes a fairly large story. And specifically, one person who sees it, hears about it, is a civil rights activist and who was the chief counsel of the NAACP at the time, Thurgood Marshall, and he steps in.
I'm just laughing because that guy is like, that's the last person you want to be in a disagreement with. The man's brilliant. He's driven. I wouldn't even play Scrabble with him. He would rock your shit. He's that smart. And so he also, of course, is guided by the principles of justice. He thinks this court-martial, the entirety of the proceedings, he thinks they're bogus. He thinks it's a diversion, the way that Matt, Noel, and I mentioned earlier. He gets special permission to fly into California, and he can sit in on the proceedings. This guy is a legal legend, too, at this point. So he's sitting in on the proceedings. He can't defend anybody. Like, he can't. The terrible comparison would be like, you know, like a vampire can't go in your house unless you invite them. He's the opposite of a vampire. He's a cool dude, but he can't interfere officially because he's a civilian. It's a military court. So what he can do is advise these people or consult with them. So imagine being that prosecutor, Coakley, and you're doing some shady stuff to try to get the verdict you want. And then you see just one day, just sitting there calmly, is Thurgood Marshall. He's watching you. Occasionally, he'll take out a pen, write something down.
Yeah.
And keep watching you.
It'd make your temperature rise for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And it's good that he was there. He went on a public campaign with this, and it had public support too. One of the things he called for was a government investigation, not just into Port Chicago, or not just into the Port Chicago 50, but the Navy's widespread systematic practice of assigning African-American service members to these segregated support roles or putting them in unsafe conditions. And for a while, it seemed like this would be a hard-won battle, but a battle they could win. Eleanor Roosevelt got involved and circulated some of the pamphlets, right?
Yeah, the first lady of the time. She joined up with the NAACP, and they attempted to appeal the case because we said these men got 15 years in prison and hard labor, and they got that dishonorable discharge. So they went in to appeal the case, and I'm pretty sure they lost at first, or they were unable to. They were unsuccessful at appealing the case at first. But there were two trials going on. There's a court-martial proceeding, and then there's the trial of public opinion, of what everybody is saying because of what Thurgood Marshall and several others are writing about the subject and the trial and the Port Chicago disaster.
Mm-hmm. The nation is forced to look at itself in the mirror, right? Through the lens of these events and confront its various prejudicial practices. Why? We ask ourselves in kitchen tables around America at this time, why is our government putting black men in the most dangerous jobs they can or the most menial jobs, and in either case, putting them there with no realistic hope of advancement or growth path? This is a dead-end job that could kill you. And then why are we punishing these people when they refuse to accept? These are good questions. And these probably kept Marshall awake at night for a long time. He poured a lot of his heart and soul into this. He went to those 50 guys to see if there was some way he could legally represent them instead of just having conversations with them. And he had to get explicit written permission from each of these 50 men to make an appeal for them. And he did it.
Yes, he did indeed. And on April 3rd, 1945, Marshall went to D.C. to present his case, and he pointed out that the prosecution had misled the court on the definition of mutiny, which I think we all felt pretty hard from the start. He also pointed out that the Navy had in some ways been looking for someone to blame or scapegoat for the disaster, as also seemed pretty clear to any kind of casual observer here. And here's a great quote from his testimony or from his presentation. Quote, "The accused were made scapegoats in a situation brought about by a combination of circumstances. Justice can only be done in this case by a complete reversal of the findings."
Wow. Yeah. I mean, it makes total sense. What happened afterwards, we'll just describe it to you. After the war, the Navy wasn't able to justify these sentences. The Navy was like, yeah, so we see all this writing, we see the appeal. Yeah, okay. Ooh, you know, when it was wartime, you know, back when we were doing all that, this kind of made sense. Like, the overly punitive sentences were, you know, setting example so that we don't lose a bunch of other sailors or soldiers somewhere else during the war, because we'd kind of need everybody. And, you know, we just put 50 guys in jail for 15 years. But now that the war's over, yeah, maybe that is a little harsh.
Yeah, now I don't know if we can just if we can continue going this hard on the punishment paint. So in September of 1945, this is, you know, as you said, Matt, after the close of the war, the Navy first shortens each of these 15-year mutiny sentences by 1 year. And the next month, Captain Harold Stassen says, "I think we reduce these sentences all the way down to 2 years for people who have good conduct, 3 years for the rest, and then give them credit for time served." January 6th, 1946, the Navy released 47 of the Chicago Port 50 and then immediately sent them to active duty aboard ships on the Pacific, where they were often relegated to menial labor.
That is rough. Getting jailed by your employer, essentially, then told, all right, you're done with jail. Come on back. Get on another ship. Get out of here.
I wonder what podcast jail is like, or podcast prison. Somebody's going to tell us there's a difference between podcast jail and podcast prison, I'm sure.
Ooh, I don't know. I think it's just all ad reads. Like, you have to do ad reads all day long without stopping.
They're all ad reads about the podcast laws you broke. Right.
That's it.
Oh, boy. But astute listeners, you'll notice we said 47 of these 50 men. There are three left. Two of those 50 prisoners stayed in the prison's hospital for months. They were recuperating from injuries. And there was one guy who had a what they called a bad conduct record. But this story, what's so weird about this is that there was a conspiracy on the part of the Navy, I think that's fair to say, to find someone to blame. There was an alleged conspiracy on the part of the men at Mare Island to not die, which is a conspiracy we all sort of participate in on a normal day, I imagine. But then this series of events ultimately led to the desegregation of the military. It ultimately gave the U.S. military something that other folks at first blush might think is counterintuitive. It made the military a very progressive institution, on paper at least, in terms of gender, in terms of race or religious belief, etc., because in 1948, President Truman desegregated the whole thing, not just the Navy, everything else.
The militaries, at least.
The militaries, at least, yeah. And the story doesn't end there, however.
No, this rippled outward into practically the present day, the 1990s. Freddie Meeks, one of the few surviving members of the Port Chicago 50, was encouraged to petition the president of the United States for a pardon. And, you know, this is the kind of stuff where, as history sort of looks at things through a more progressive lens, these are the types of things that pardons make a lot of sense for, right? Others of the Port Chicago 50 had refused to ask for a pardon, reasoning that it implied guilt on their part, that only guilty people needed to receive forgiveness. Like, it was some kind of absolution, acknowledging that their crime had been committed. So they continued to hold firm on that position, the position being that they were not guilty of mutiny in the first place, which I think we've, again, through that modern lens, pretty unequivocally proven.
Yeah, and you, again, you can look at YouTube videos and a bunch of writing on this right now. There's a YouTube video from NBC Bay Area, and it's called The Port Chicago Disaster 75 Years Later, where you can hear a story from a man named William Ross, who was a survivor from the Port Chicago disaster. And, you know, you can hear his story. You can hear the story of several writers who have been researching this for a long time. And you can hear that argument against pardon. And it's a really strong argument to say pardon is not the right thing here. Exoneration is the only way forward for this.
Right, right. And that I agree that is a solid argument. Meek's logic for applying for a pardon was to bring more public awareness to these events and to the miscarriage of justice. It was successful to a degree. In December of 1999, then-President Clinton pardoned Meeks, who would go on to pass away in June of 2003. And efforts to posthumously not pardon but exonerate all 50 sailors continue to this day. The story takes us to a better place, but it's by no means done yet. If you are in the area, you can check out the Port Chicago Naval Magazine National Memorial, which was dedicated in 1994 to the hundreds of lives lost in the explosion. And there, for now, until we get more news, the episode draws to a close. What do you think, folks? It is somewhat rare Longtime listeners, you know this, it is somewhat rare for us to have an episode with a happy ending of like any sort. And this is sort of a happy ending because justice is slowly being done, and it led to tremendous, I would say, cultural advancements in this country, but it's not over. I don't know.
No, it's not over. And, you know, there's something that we didn't touch on here, and it's not even really worth looking into. But because of the nature of this explosion, how large it was and how very little was left behind, it's very difficult to prove what caused, what is the thing that sparked the explosion, you know?
Yes.
And, of course, you could get lost in rumor and, you know, just thinking about that as, whoa, could it have been, you know, an attack from the outside? You just go down that rabbit hole forever. But in the end, in all likelihood, it was an accident that caused it. And that's why this, you know, is so important to talk about the way the Navy handled the men that caused an accident because they didn't know what they were doing. But again, there still lies in there the possibility that it was something else. And I think that has fueled some discussion of this disaster for quite a time. I don't have any answers there, but it is something you could look into if you're interested.
Like, what if what if this was a cover up for something even more embarrassing, an attack, right? A successful enemy attack or sabotage of Port Chicago, which in that case makes the Navy and Uncle Sam look even worse, because instead of ponying up the truth, they doubled down and blamed these guys. That's terrible, but you're absolutely right. The official explanation is unknown. Like, it's literally, we don't know what happened. We just know that something made one thing explode, which made other things explode, which made other things explode.
Yeah. Ugh, really tragic, man.
And I would advance another thing here at the end of our time together today. What other stories like this are out there? I am sure there are many. I am sure that scapegoating soldiers is not something restricted to the United States or to the modern era. What stories like this have you heard from your neck of the global woods? Have you experienced something like this firsthand? If so, let us know. We try to be easy to find. We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram. We're on Twitter. Check us out at Here's Where It Gets Crazy, which is our Facebook community page. But wait, you say, I hate social media. You guys are great. I just can't do it. I don't even talk to my mom on Facebook. Well, that's fine. We have another way for you to get in touch with us.
Well, first, call your mom, then immediately dial 1-833-STDWYTK and leave us a message, 3 minutes, if you please, or less, and you might find, let us know if it's okay to use what you want us to call you, if it's okay to use your audio, and you might hear yourself in one of our weekly listener mail episodes.
And if you don't want to do that, you can, of course, well, what's another good way to reach us, guys? Oh, I know. There's that old-fashioned email that we keep around that a lot of you write into and we read every week, every day of every week. It is
conspiracy@iheartradio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.